Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Diane Yentel, President and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration's effort to impose rent increases and work requirements on millions of poor families. Shakor Aljuwani of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative, who describes how renewable energy and the cooperative model can work together to empower communities. And Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, who maintains that a right-wing coup impeached Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and has now imprisoned former President Lula da Silva. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Israeli government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is dropping its plan to deport thousands of African migrants after failing to find a willing country to take them. The government had planned to deport migrant men, primarily from Sudan and Eritrea, who crossed the Sinai Desert to enter Israel. Human rights groups filed a petition before the Israeli Supreme Court to halt the deportations that would have impacted 37,000 African migrants. According to the Washington Post, the deportation plan was thought to be unconstitutional by many legal observers. The migrants, who will now be able to renew their residency permits every 60 days, as they were before the deportation effort, claim they are seeking asylum in Israel and fleeing persecution. Earlier, Netanyahu had said that after failing to reach agreement with any country to accept the migrants, he would try to draft legislation that would permit the reopening of detention camps to house the refugees in Israel. However, Israel's Supreme Court has previously struck down legislation that permits such detention and ordered the facilities shut down. In the last 6 months, only 44 Syrian refugees have been permitted to be resettled in the United States, just a fraction of those welcomed in the previous 2 years. Once in office, President Donald Trump cut in half the number of refugees allowed to enter America. International Rescue Committee Vice President Hans van der Weerde insists the Trump White House is using every red tape measure they have to slow down the flow of arrivals. The slowdown comes as the Supreme Court is reviewing the constitutionality of Trump's travel ban from select Muslim nations. Before Trump entered the White House, the U.S. had accepted nearly 24,000 Syrian refugees from Jordan in 2016. Last year, the number of refugees accepted fell to 3,700. While Trump has restricted the number of Muslims entering the U.S., he allows a larger proportion of European Christians, whom he prefers, according to the Christian Science Monitor. In a meeting with lawmakers in January, the president described the nations in Africa and Central America that the migrants are fleeing as S-hole countries. As a candidate, Trump repeatedly called for a total shutdown of Muslims coming to the U.S. Fox News host Sean Hannity has amassed a $90 million real estate empire, owning over 800 homes in 7 states with the aid of U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development financing. Hannity, a friend and unofficial advisor to President Trump, worked with shady real estate speculator Jeff Brock, who was convicted of a criminal conspiracy to manipulate the sale of foreclosed properties. The Guardian newspaper reports that in 2012, a shell company linked to Hannity purchased 11 foreclosed homes in Georgia that had been purchased by Brock. Brock transferred the properties to corporate vehicles that sold them back to the Hannity-linked company at a profit. 4 years later, Brock pled guilty to charges of bank fraud and conspiracy for his role in rigging foreclosure auctions. Brock was sentenced to 6 months in prison and was forced to pay $160,000 in fines. An attorney for Hannity denied the millionaire Fox News host was aware of any fraud committed in dealing with Brock. Hannity's real estate investments were supported by HUD underwriting to the tune of $18 million in mortgages, funding that was renewed by HUD Secretary Ben Carson. Hannity, who makes $36 million a year from his radio and TV shows, was recently named in court as a client of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. Yet, the right-wing media star was condemned for defending Cohen and Trump on the air without disclosing to his audience that he also consulted Cohen for legal services relating to his real estate dealings. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As many as 2 million public housing tenants could face rent increases if Congress approves a proposal made by the Trump administration's Housing and Urban Development Secretary, Ben Carson. Dr. Carson, a former neurosurgeon, announced his plan called the Making Affordable Housing Work Act on April 25th. The reform package would require households that receive federal housing subsidies to pay 35% of their gross income in rent, up from the current 30% required, and triple the minimum monthly rent for the poorest families from $50 to $150. The HUD proposal would also allow local public housing authorities to impose work requirements on renters. That effort is supported by President Trump, who signed an executive order mandating that federal agencies evaluate employment rules for most government welfare programs. With this initiative and others, the Trump administration and congressional Republicans aim to restrict access to federal social safety net programs and reduce the levels of assistance allocated to low-income individuals and families who qualify. Your reporter spoke with Diane Yentel, president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, who takes a critical look at HUD's efforts to impose rent increases in work requirements and the consequences for millions of poor Americans.
I think what's especially appalling about these proposed rent increases is that they target the very poorest people, including seniors and people with disabilities who are already often living on fixed incomes and are at significant risk of homelessness. The proposal would increase rents for households with high medical or high child care expenses by eliminating income deductions for those expenses. So the greatest burdens would be felt by seniors, people with disabilities, and families with young kids who tend to have those high costs. So I think it's appalling, and it's important to recognize that these attempts to raise those rents on the most vulnerable people are really part of a larger assault by this administration on the entire social safety net. And I think that this administration's proposals to take away what are already very limited benefits for health care, for food, and for housing from struggling families just months after giving massive tax cuts to wealthy people and corporations is really an astonishing level of hypocrisy.
I wondered if you would address Ben Carson's statement where he talked about the justification for these rent increases, trying to get away from a system that he claims has introduced perverse incentives, discouraging employment by many public housing tenants. How do you respond to the idea that somehow the federal subsidies coming from HUD are discouraging people from being gainfully employed and earning larger incomes?
First of all, that kind of rhetoric is really unfortunate because it's a purposeful attempt to kind of separate out what some might consider the deserving poor from the undeserving poor, right? And when we look at who is receiving housing assistance today, the vast majority of them are seniors, they're people with disabilities, they are caretakers for people with disabilities or very young kids, or they are working, but they're working very low-wage jobs, the kind of jobs where you can't pay the kind of rents that are out there today, and the kind of jobs where often it can be difficult to kind of cobble together enough hours in a week or in a month to make ends meet. So creating arbitrary work requirements where you're setting kind of an arbitrary bar for the number of hours that need to be worked in a week, if that family isn't able to get that number of hours in that week or in that month and they fall below that bar, are we really proposing that that family should be evicted from their housing? I mean, who is that helping, especially in the midst of the type of housing crisis that we're in today? There are programs within Secretary Carson's purview, within the Department of Housing and Urban Development, that could work to help people increase their earnings, programs like something called the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. There's another program called the Section 3 program, and that requires local communities to use HUD dollars that create jobs to first offer those jobs to low-income tenants or other low-income residents in the community. That's a regulation that's really very loosely overseen. Secretary Carson could do much more on that. He could seek funding to take the Family Self-Sufficiency Program to scale, but he's not doing any of those things. Instead, he's proposing policies really that are punishing poor people for being poor.
Diane, I wanted to ask you about the impact of this increased rent and the work requirements. What's liable to be the outcome for some of these poor families that will be at the other end of this policy if it goes through Congress?
Well, so here's something that we've known about housing costs for decades and have had general agreement among housing experts and policymakers. And that is that if you're paying more than 30% of your income towards rent each month, you're considered to be cost burdened. It means that you have limited income left over for all of life's other necessities. When you're low income to begin with and you're paying more than 30% of your very limited income, you have even less left for things like healthy food or medicine to stay healthy, or saving for the future, saving for college or saving for retirement. So what HUD is actually proposing to do here is to increase the rent burdens on some of the lowest income people across the country. For most residents of HUD's major rental programs, it would mean increasing their rent from 30% of their income up to 35% of their income. And from 30% of adjusted, where they make some adjustments for those high medical costs or childcare costs, to 35% of gross without any deductions at all. That's a really significant income for very low-income people. And for the very lowest, the poorest and the most vulnerable households that are in HUD-subsidized homes today, they typically pay what's called a minimum rent, which could be up to about $50 a month. For them, HUD is proposing a mandatory minimum rent of $150, so tripling the rent of literally the poorest and most vulnerable households. So any of this will mean that people will be at a much higher risk of not being able to pay the rent, facing possible eviction and possible homelessness.
That was Diane Yentel, President and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's effort to slash government social safety net programs for poor families by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. An Albany, New York protest on April 23rd, dubbed Walk the Talk on Climate Leadership, drew more than 1,500 people, the city's largest climate action ever. A broad coalition of activists from across the state gathered that day to demand New York Governor Andrew Cuomo take action for a fossil-free world. At a training session the day before the rally and mass nonviolent civil disobedience action, one of the presenters was Shakur Al-Jawani, coordinator of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative and chairperson of Co-op Power, which is a network of community energy cooperatives. He described how different forms of renewable energy and the cooperative model can work together to empower communities with both energy independence and economic development. Shakur says renewable energy can provide good-paying jobs that workers can feel good about rather than contributing to the degradation of the environment. He adds that renewable energy co-ops are a good way to keep money circulating through low-income communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the training and spoke with Shakur after his presentation.
Well, we're building a multi-race, multi-class movement for sustainable energy. And part of that is being able to set up a network of cooperatives where we can begin to make decisions about what our energy needs are in our local areas, and then be able to use our cooperative power to help finance those new solutions. So whether it's building a biodiesel plant made from recycled vegetable oil in Greenfield, or a worker co-op energy efficiency installation in Holyoke within Ahia, or putting solar arrays on low-income housing cooperatives as we're doing in New York City. It's an approach where each city can decide what their focus is, and then use our cooperative power as a local area and as a region to be able to make our solutions work.
So who's funding this?
We fund it largely through our own efforts, I mean, and that's the power of it. We'll go out and get grants and some other things to try to supplement, get a grant to help do worker training or some other thing like that. But generally, we start it with cooperative dollars, and then we use new ideas like bringing strategic tax investors that are looking for a tax break, and at the same time, concerned about their communities and their planet, and want to figure out a way to support innovative approaches. And so we use those to help us finance initially on the solar array, like putting a 7.9 kilowatts on the Nazareth housing on the East 11th Street in the Lower East Side, and then do an approach where we will buy that investor out within 5 to 7 years, and then either keep it in the cooperative or sell it back at extremely good rate to the particular building organization that it's a part of.
It sounds like you work right now mostly in New York and Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yes, and we're also doing work in Burlington, Vermont. Put a solar array on top of the Foo Cooperative in Burlington, Vermont.
I've been to Burlington and I've been to the co-op. That's great. That's, okay. That seems like a good fit.
Yep.
So I just wonder, in the states where you have been working, are there state policies that are helping or hindering the development of this great-sounding project?
We started out in Massachusetts, and for a good bit of time, Massachusetts has, you know, along with California, a leader in the country for green energy. And there's been some backsliding on that, but we've developed a network, and we have an approach where we try to connect up with folks inside those bureaucratic systems that are trying to make a difference, and they're there, and figure out ways of how we can squeeze the most good out of whatever policies that a state has. So.
And what about utilities? In Connecticut, we've been trying to get shared solar year after year at the General Assembly, and I don't know, there's some hope we're going to get it this year, but every other year, the utilities have just opposed it so fiercely, and they throw a lot of money at it, and we haven't been able to get it through, even though it's very common in a lot of other states.
It's a problem. This situation is slowly improving, but way too slowly. And we've done the same where, you know, where we try to develop a good working relationship with those folks inside of whether it's Con Edison in New York City or Eversource or Wormeco or some of the others. But it's a difficult battle, and we see now that not only got to work to provide the positive solutions, but we got to stand shoulder to shoulder with folks that are out there fighting to open some doors so that renewable energy is really supported and given the chance so that it needs to be able to make a difference. And then we have to figure out a way of how to retrain people in jobs of the future that makes sense. And not only are we creating jobs, but we're able to create wealth and bring that money from the sun creating energy on our roofs, that money can stay in the community instead of going to some investors in some other place. It's important for us to look at the power of cooperatives and the power of solar energy and other renewables as a way of making a difference and hopefully being able to stop the aggressive growth of climate change.
That was Shakur Aljiwani, coordinator of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative and chairperson of Co-op Power, speaking at a training session before the April 23rd civil disobedience action, demanding climate leadership from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Learn more about what climate activists are doing in New York by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The imprisonment of Brazil's popular former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, on April 7th, appears to have completed what many observers charge is a successful right-wing coup undertaken against the nation's Progressive Workers' Party leadership. Lula, who had been a leading presidential candidate in this October's national election, is now serving a 12-year sentence on corruption and money laundering charges, even as he continues to appeal his case. Brazil's first female president, Dilma Rousseff, also of the Workers' Party, succeeded Lula as president in 2011 and won a second term in office in the 2014 election. However, she was impeached from office by the Brazilian Senate in August 2016 on charges that she violated fiscal regulations by using funds from state banks to cover budget shortfalls in order to continue funding popular anti-poverty programs. The charges of corruption in the Lava Jato or car wash investigation have eroded support for the Workers' Party and other major parties and politicians across Brazil. But many of Lula's and Rousseff's policies remain popular. For their success in reducing poverty by 55%, extreme poverty by 65%, and an overall decrease in rampant inequality. Your reporter spoke with Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Here, Professor Mendonça explains why she believes that a right-wing coup is responsible for the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff and now the imprisonment of Lula da Silva, and what the future holds for progressive political forces in Brazil.
In 2016, there was a coup against President Dilma Rousseff. She was elected and then re-elected. And that was after Lula was elected and re-elected. So the Workers' Party had been in power for four consecutive elections in Brazil and implementing a progressive agenda in the country, social programs that were very popular. So the right-wing parties knew that they could not win elections. They could not take power through a democratic process. So they orchestrated a parliamentary coup against President Dilma Rousseff. And they used an excuse saying that, you know, she had committed some administrative crime. But the thing is, her administration was doing something very common that all the previous administrations had done, which was to delay payments from the federal budget to the public banks to pay for social programs such as low-income housing, for example. And most Brazilians don't even understand the reason for the impeachment, because people think that she was accused of corruption, but they had no case of corruption against her. So the main reason for the impeachment was for the right-wing powers to take over the government and to implement a conservative agenda to cut social programs, you know, to privatize public companies, to implement austerity measures in Brazil that were not popular. And then this year, former President Lula was leading the polls for the presidential elections that will happen in October, are supposed to happen. We don't know what's going to happen because there is such political instability in the country now. And they also orchestrated a case against him saying that he received an apartment as a bribe, but there is no proof that he owns. He doesn't own the apartment. He never spent any time in the apartment. So all the case was based in one testimony of a company executive, a construction company executive that was in prison and had his sentence reduced from like 15 years to 2 years in exchange for accusing Lula. So, you know, now he's in prison and he's still very popular even after his arrest. If elections were today, he would win in all types of cases, of scenarios.
Lula is in prison. I've heard there is a protest encampment out in front of the prison building where he is now located. What is the future of the Workers' Party and other progressive popular movements such as MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, as they confront a system that has veered very much hard right over recent years?
Yes, the social movements in Brazil face a great deal of repression now. Just a few days ago, this camp in front of the prison was attacked by gunmen, and they shot at people when they were sleeping, and two people got wounded. So, that is a serious threat of repression. Almost all types of mobilizations, protests face now police violence. And we also had the case a little over a month ago of a congresswoman from Rio, Marielle Franco, who was assassinated with four bullets in the head and killed. So, you know, in addition to dozens of leaders of social movements, peasant movements, the landless workers movements, who have been killed since last year. So we see a great deal of repression in the countryside and in urban areas, and also, you know, of social leaders, grassroots movements, and also any type of protest against the coup. Usually, you know, the response is police repression. After the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff, we realized that we could not trust any institutions in the country. The Supreme Court is part of the coup. Mainstream media outlets support the coup. It's really difficult for people to mobilize. That's why having international visibility is important.
That was Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Learn more about the current political crisis in Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Carib Rhythms International Radio in Tucker, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.